legs themselves are going to be black. The legs, you know, there's four legs that open up, and they wind up 60 foot wide. You know, each one is like 30 foot long. And then when they open up, they lock in place and they land. But then the crew has to completely disconnect these legs to, you know, when they're going to do another flight. With this system, they're beefed up, first of all, they're heavier, more heavy duty. But they'll be able to fold the legs back up in place and reuse the legs the way they are. So he's trying to cut the cost down even more on relaunching these vehicles. So I thought that was pretty good. That will be taking off May 4th. I want to see how that one works out. He'll be landing that booster on a autonomous drone ship at sea out in the Atlantic Ocean. Another flight right after the next day, May 5th, will be from California, from Vandenberg Air Force Base. And that's the one I'm looking forward to, because that one's going to Mars. That's the InSight mission. So InSight will be flying on an Atlas V on what they call a 401 configuration. So it'll be a 4-meter diameter fairing on top, and then no boosters attached to it. And that will be going into a polar orbit. It's going to start off with a polar orbit, head out toward, you know, south toward the Antarctic, and then he'll do almost a complete orbit before the separation of the second stage and the InSight, before it starts heading to Mars. And when it gets to Mars, they plan on landing on a equatorial plane on a Elysium Planitia is the location where it's going to be landing. No rocks in the way, no nothing. They need a very stable piece of property to land this thing, because this thing is going to have seismograph on there. It's going to be able to also drill into the, or hammer its way into the planet down around 15 feet. And when it does, it's going to drag a thermometer down with it. And, you know, it's going to land. It's going to be taking off, like I said, in May 5th, and landing in November, the day after Thanksgiving. But it's going to take roughly 4 to 5 weeks before all these different components are put onto the planet. They have a robotic arm, and they'll put one onto the planet, another piece over it, and so on and so forth. Before you start getting data back, they expect it to be about 3 or 4 months. This is WS2M. We're talking about InSight, I think last week and the week before, and one of the topics that we were discussing, on this flight, they're going to have two additional satellites going with the InSight mission, and they're called Mars Cube 1, and Mars Cube 1 has an A and a B to it, so there's two satellites that are going to be actually following InSight all the way to Mars. After the Atlas V launches from Vandenberg, and the first booster separates, you'll have the second booster, which is called the Centaur. Centaur is a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket that's flown probably 500 different times. And that's their second stage. And that will have the, on front of that, they will have the InSight attached to it. Right after InSight separates from that stage, now the booster, you know, will be drifting slightly behind it. On the booster itself, they have two satellites, and it's called Mars Cube 1, which is they call it Marco. So Marco A, Marco B. Marco A will separate from the booster and continue on following InSight. Marco B will separate from the booster and continue on and follow InSight all the way to Mars for the next 6 months. reason for these two satellites is going to be for almost instant communication. It's really a proof of concept type of mission. No CubeSats have really ever left Earth orbit, although it is 800, and I'm not kidding, about 800 CubeSats that have been launched since its inception back in the late 1990s. And each CubeSat is roughly about 4 inches cube. It's 10 centimeters cube. So you figure out 4 inches. And then they have different ones. You could have a 2U, that would be 2 units. 3U, 3U would be 3 units. So, you know, each one is a multiple of this single cube, which is four inch cube, with all the electronics and everything. This one is going to be six U. Marco satellite will be a 6U unit, roughly about the size of a briefcase. So it will separate from the Centaur booster, and they will both be following InSight, and then they have their own propulsion system. The propulsion system will orient this thing properly, because the next thing that happens with these small satellites is they're going to open up antenna and solar wings, you know, solar panels. So some solar panels will open up, provide power for this thing, and then this large flat antenna, and that will be the X-band, will open up. And it looks like it's, I don't know, when you look at it, it looks like about a meter square. But that will be the antenna for the X-band communication. And then they have a UHF antenna on board as well. The reason for this whole setup with the two bands is that when they get to Mars, they'll be copying information from the InSight lander before it goes into the entry and descent. That, you know, when that thing goes into that type of, which is a normal blackout type of period for these satellites, not only for the plasma when it's entering Mars, but also because of the communications. They transmit, as they're going down, they transmit a carrier on the InSight vehicle itself. That gets picked up normally by an orbiting satellite. In this case, it's going to be the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. And that usually acts as a repeater. And eventually, they store the information on board on the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. And then eventually, as another orbit goes by, and the Mars Reconnaissance sort of orbiter comes around, which is roughly an hour later, then they start sending signals back on the X-band back to the deep space network at Earth. But then there's a delay, you know, roughly an hour and a half before the information gets back to Earth, and we won't necessarily know if this thing landed. There's another system that they also use when this thing is transmitting. The deep space network is trying to pick up InSight as it's going in directly. And they've done that a couple of times, where they'll follow it pretty much all the way down to the surface, and they'll know right in real time when this thing has actually landed. But to make sure that they get all the information and data in a better fashion, these satellites will be following it. And the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter doesn't, you know, they have transponders, but they don't have cross bands, so the InSight is sending it up on UHF, and then eventually it has to be transmitted back on the X-band. Since the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter can't do that, these little ones can, these little Marco or Mars Cube 1 and 2 satellites are going to be able to do exactly that. As the transmissions are coming up in UHF, it'll be sending out on the X-band at the exact time, real time, back to the deep space network. I know we talked about that. I know Dip brought it up a couple of times, and I finally got a couple of answers on these things. So if you want to talk about this, and I can go on to other stuff later that, you know, this or something else, we could do that. Back to you, Dick. K2RI, WWS2N.
That's your choice, Paul. Go right ahead.
Okay, very good. So I thought that was well worth discussing. Another interesting occurrence that happened last week right here on Long Island was another international space station contact with another school. This time it was in Central Islip. And Weimark didn't help out, but the Great South Bay Radio Club did. And they did a good job. Originally, I read the information off of one of the ARRL emails, and it said that they were going to be doing this. And they gave the website for the live stream, so I put that on. Sure enough, they did a great job. They had like 800, I think it was 800 people in the school.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, what they did was direct contact to the space station, and they had a certain exact time, exact second when they were going to start making these contacts. They lined up 20 children, which is a lot. When I got involved in it, we had 18, and they were hoping for, we had 12 people, but 18 or 19 questions got through. They lined up like 20 of them. And the guy started, he started calling the ISS, the exact time. But the seconds were ticking by, and they made it dramatic because about 5 minutes went by, and they had the one student there getting ready to ask her question, and the time was ticking. And, you know, each school that gets involved in it, they spend like a year, almost a year to get this done. They have all kinds of programs and everybody involved. And I'm watching this and I'm saying, this, I hope they got the attendance pointing right. What's going on here? They went, looked like they switched microphones. I'm not sure what they did there. But finally, after about 5 minutes, they did make the contact. You heard the astronaut, but the astronaut could not hear Central Islip. But eventually that worked out, and sure enough, they went that whole 10 minutes, if not longer, and they got every single question, and every kid got to ask their questions. So that was pretty neat. Good job by the Great South Bay Amateur Radio Club and by the district contacting Ricky Arnold, KE5DAU. So that was well worth watching. And I would imagine if you go to that same site, you probably could see a repeat of that. And if anybody's on from the Great South Bay, maybe they have that information. Let me check to see if anybody does have that information or any comments about the contact between the ISS and the Central Islip School District. Okay, very good. And there was apparently, from what I was reading, a music teacher, KD2IFR, and he was involved with, I believe he was the one that was speaking, trying to make the contact. But I'm not sure about that. But he did a fantastic job, very well done. And these things are getting out of hand. I mean, afterwards they have, not only do they have broadcasting going through the computer, they have cheerleaders and school bands. I couldn't believe it. I mean, it's good to see that kind of enthusiasm with science and with the space program. And then, sure enough, in Alabama, they had another contact recently, also with Ricky Arnold, K5DAU, with Tinston Valley High School in Alabama. I read that story, and after the contact, I mean, they were out, apparently they were out in the school football SEAL. They had a speech from a Navy SEAL. He's going on, apparently on and on about maybe the space program. I don't know. I don't have the tech on that. And then right after that, they had four Navy SEALs come out of the sky out of on parachutes, along with the vice principal of the school. They parachuted down, and my guess probably wound up on a 50-yard line of the school. So it's really becoming a big thing with, it's been going on for, what, almost 20 years now. Before that, they had the SARAX program. Before ARIES, which is the amateur radio on International Space Station, before that they had the SARAX program, which was the shuttle contacts. You'd have hams on board contacting schools. And, so this has been going on over 20 years. But it's amazing. You would think there would be less enthusiasm. Meanwhile, they have people jumping out of airplanes to celebrate the occasions. Okay, that's pretty much it. One interesting note I know I've talked about many years ago, the WISE satellite that used to look for asteroids and different things. That had a 2-year mission back in, I think it was 2009 when it launched, and then it went dormant for about a year after its conclusion, but then they brought it back to life, and they call it NEOWISE. So they continued on with it, and now there's a report on how many tens of thousands of asteroids and comets and near-Earth objects that are out there, and there's like tens of thousands of these things. It was released by the principal investigator. And it's actually on a NASA website and a couple of the other websites, and you can go to it and you can click on it. It's just a quick video of all the tens of thousands of things that this thing has picked up. They're trying to document everything, make sure nothing's going to come by and hit us in the middle of the night. So that was pretty interesting. And that's pretty much it. I don't have that much other information, but we're here for questions or comments. Let me turn it back to you. See you, Dick. K2RIW, this is WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet.
Yeah, we forgot to mention that the Near East Astronomy Forum held its conference at Rockland Community College today and yesterday. I wonder if anyone within the sound of my voice got a chance to go and what they thought. Anybody who went to the NEAF conference on frequency want to tell us what it was like? Give me a call. That is right now, K2RIW. One of the things I've looked at over the last week or so, Paul, is the TESS satellite information that got launched last week. And what's unique about TESS is that over the next couple of years, it's not going to just survey a very small chunk of sky, equivalent to looking down a straw. That's what Kepler did, and it discovered a couple of thousand exoplanets, but almost all of them it discovered were very far away. What TESS is doing instead is going to survey, the first year I think it's going to survey the southern hemisphere, and the second year the northern hemisphere, but essentially the whole dawn sky. I think something like 85% of the sky is going to be surveyed. And what's unique about TESS is that instead of taking a very high resolution of very far away stars, let me drop. It's a slightly less angular resolution telescope, but much broader a field of view. And so 24 by 24 degrees is each of the four separate telescopes that operate simultaneously. And they get pasted together as to one vertical stripe that's 96 degrees high, as I remember. And then that gets stepped in azimuth. So it's going to be looking for the closer, brighter stars that have a transit, in other words, a transit where the planet of the star goes in front of the star. Therefore, it's anticipated that TESS is going to discover more exoplanets than Kepler did. There are people who think it's going to be interviewing a total of half a million stars, which ones have planets, and by measuring the nearby stars, let me drop it. It'll be finding stars that are closer, that are where you stand a chance of making more thorough measurements of the planet size and the planet's gravity, density, composition, atmosphere, and so on. So they're going to probably find a significantly more larger number of planets going around in nearby stars than Kepler did, and because they're so close, we'll be able to measure which of those stars have what kind of an atmosphere. If, for instance, you find a lot of oxygen or methane in the atmosphere, it strongly suggests that biological life exists on that planet, and therefore you know where to point your high-resolution ground-based telescopes, and where in the very near future we're going to be taking the James Webb Space Telescope, and with its massive mirror, looking at the atmosphere of these planets. In terms of, as I see it, James Webb and TESS are going to be strongly complementing each other, with a little bit of backup from Hubble to make measurements of these nearby exoplanets. So it looks like in the very near future, we're going to know a lot more about which of these planets are in the Goldilocks zone, potentially have life. Let me drop. And as I see it, the combination of James Webb, TESS, Hubble, and the infrared and ultraviolet satellites making all these measurements, it's quite possible that finding life external to the Earth by way of these astronomical techniques might be ahead of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETI searches, being done by radio astronomy techniques, because whether or not a society radiates a strong broadcast signal that we can detect might be more difficult than measuring whether or not their planet has the right atmosphere and the right location from that star so that life is likely. So when it comes to finding those other guys that are out there, the little green men that we sometimes make a joke about, quite possibly these new astronomical satellites are going to find that extra life first. Might have some comments on all this, so let me drop. TESS is going to be, in the next few weeks, establishing itself in this rather complicated orbit, tilted at 39 degrees, doing a flyby of the moon in order to tilt the orbit, and the orbit has an apogee out approximately the distance of the moon, and a perigee that's, I think, twice the altitude of the geosynchronous satellites. So the nice thing about TESS is that it's got this two orbits per month, very nice, gentle, wide orbits, always outside of the Van Allen belt, and it's going to be doing an awful lot of measurements. The total amount of data that will be coming down from TESS is so great that I think they're going to be asking for amateur people to help them review the data to look for the exoplanets. Probably have comments on all of the above, Paul. I think TESS is doing very well, and it looks like it's got a glamorous future if it even does half the things it's intended to do. WS2N, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
Yes, it was successfully launched from Launch Complex 40, and that, again, was by a Falcon 9 rocket. And if you watch the, I had two computers on at the same time. I watched NASA, and I watched the SpaceX version. They successfully landed that booster on the barge. You got to see it with NASA, but they spent a lot more time on the pictures from the SpaceX site. So that worked out good. And the later on in the flight, the solar panels opened up on TESS. They knew everything was working. It was communicating. They said it's going perfectly. And it will take about 2 months to get this thing into its proper P divided by 2, it's like P/2 orbit, they call it. For every revolution of the moon, you're going to have 2 orbits of tests. And the missing data, if you look at the map, like you said, there's like 85% or so that's being covered by tests. The one guy asked in a question, and you know, I got the answer by listening to him. What's happening with the other, you know, 5 to 10%? He says that's being picked up by Kepler. So since we, you know, we're going to have that data, we don't need to do this, so we're concentrating more on the areas that we're doing. So I thought that was a very good answer. So in reality, you probably have 100% by the time the 2 years is done. And, to get out to that orbit, they need to do 3 orbits of Earth, each one increasing. Every time they come to perigee, they'll light off the kick motor and push it further out until it gets out to around the location where the moon would normally be. And in that one case, after the 3 orbits, the moon actually will be there. They're going to use that moon, and like you said, they're going to use it as a gravity assist to change inclination. They're going to come around the South Pole, and then moon, and then by doing that, they'll be able to change the inclination from 22 or 23 degrees of Earth to about 39 degrees of in relationship to the moon, and that will change in relationship with the Earth as the seasons change, because we're on a 21 degree tilt. So that's the orbit. About 2 months from now, they'll start getting information. But they will be checking and actually getting other information within that period. They're going to be calibrating and checking everything out, making sure everything works, do one camera at a time, so they know everything's online. So looking forward to the results of that mission. The follow-up missions will also be done by not only James Webb, but another one that's going to be launched within probably about 3 or 4 years, maybe longer, maybe 5 years, or so many things are going, called WFIRST, and WFIRST will also be out in the L2 position, out where James Webb is going to be. That should, between that one and James Webb, they're going to get a lot of information. Unfortunately, James Webb is having some trouble, so presently it's 2020. And I'm starting to wonder if it's going to be delayed even more. This was supposed to go up by now. Now we're talking about a couple more years. So that might be a problem. It sounds like one complicated contraption. They're talking about 80 to 100 different things that have to mechanically be done and move. And everyone has to go 100% right to make this thing work. Going out to the L2 position, you can't send out any astronauts like you did on Hubble to do any work. But just want to go back to the beginning where I was talking about making space flight a little cheaper. There's another rocket coming online. They've been working on this thing for about 3 or 4 years. And it was called the Next Generation Launch Vehicle, and it was being built by Orbital ATK. Orbital ATK is a company that also launches Antares up to the International Space Station with cargo on board, carrying the Cygnus spacecraft. And they've done quite a few cargo missions to the space station. This company is now going to be building what they used to call the Next Generation Launch Vehicle for the last 3 years. They finally gave it a name called the Omega. Omega with a capital A at the end. I don't get that, but that's going to be the name, the Omega Launch Vehicle. It's already in development. It's based on a solid booster rocket that you would have from the space shuttle. Orbital ATK is very good at solid booster rockets. And the whole rocket is going to have two stages. It's got a solid booster, and it's going to have other additional boosters attached to the side of it. And to make a long story short, this thing's going to be about 200 feet tall. And it's going to be able to pack probably three or four million pounds of thrust. I guess by the time they put all these extra boosters on. So it's another one that's going to be used, another one the United States is going to be depending on. Because eventually, somewhere down the road, they plan on putting people on this thing as well. But in the beginning, it's going to be for satellites, it's going to be for launching military satellites, very heavy satellites to either orbit or interplanetary. And they'll be launching from Florida, from Launch Complex 39B. The 39A and 39B. 39A and 39B were both used by the Apollo program, and eventually they used them for launching space shuttles. You know, maybe 54 of them went off on one, 60 or so went off on the other. Since that's been retired, they took Launch Complex 39A and turned it over to SpaceX, and they've been launching for the last year or so from 39A with their Falcon 9 rockets. In fact, they had the Falcon 9 Heavy launch from 39A. That was the one that made all the news, where they put that Tesla car in the rocket and sent it halfway to Mars. So 39B is being built and redesigned for the space launch system that NASA's putting together, which will eventually have the Orion spacecraft, which will be able to send people to the moon or even Mars. But since those flights will only average maybe one a year, the question came up, what do we do with Launch Complex 39B when the space launch system is not being used? Orbital ATK had an idea. Let's build our own big launch vehicle, and we're going to use 39B when you're not using it, when NASA's not using it, to launch their big 200-foot solid booster rocket that's being developed. So, between them, SpaceX with the Falcon rocket, you have Blue Origin building the New Glenn, which is going to be a massive rocket, almost the size of Saturn V, all these large vehicles. It's very good for the United States, including our allies, European Space Agency with the Ariane 5, soon to have the Ariane 6. And after a while, we're not going to be able to keep track of all these rockets going up. Back to you, Dick, WS2M.
One other thing I read about tests is that each of the four cameras is taking a picture of the sky 24 degrees wide, 24 degrees high. And the four are stacked together vertically. Four times 24 is, I think, 96 degrees. And they only have to look at 90 degrees, a vertical swath, to view each chunk of the southern hemisphere and then the northern hemisphere. As such, every one of the azimuth swaths, in other words, it's going to step in azimuth every period of time, but you have an overlapping area over the South Pole, celestial South Pole, during the first year. That overlapping area means that you'll be getting, for a small number of degrees near the celestial pole, South Pole at first, you'll be getting a continuous observation. As such, I think backed up by Kepler and James Webb and whatever, I think some of the much longer period planets around a star can be observed, and also you're getting a lot more individual data. I'm not quite sure I understood all that's taking place, but I know they've intentionally made this overlapping area at the celestial pole in order to give longer looks for those particular exoplanets in that area. Did you understand what the advantage of that was, Paul? I read it a little bit too fast. WS2N, KQRIW.
Yeah, because of the orbital mechanics, it's good. They wind up staring at poles actually longer. I mean, ideally, they like to stare at the whole sky 100% without it moving the cameras, but they can't. But it works out that the poles are going to be able to have more time. Roughly, each one is going to be covered for 27 days. So, you know, every point of light, the poles will be more so. That's the way I understood it. And, yeah, you know, you got roughly 14-day orbit, so what, 13.7 days. So each time you're going around, you know, it's staring at one location, but the next time you come around, you're still basically staring at the same location. It's a cumulative, and they said the average, I think, is going to be 27 days per star. Well, not star, per location. And like you're right, it was over 200,000 stars they're going to be looking at, and most of them are going to be closer. A lot closer than what Kepler was staring at, which was some of them were, you know, 1,000 or 1,500 light years away. These things are going to be roughly 200 light years away, and I think they're going to be, in most cases, 10 or 15 times brighter than what Kepler looked at. So that's pretty good. And this, like you said, was the data is so much that, you know, out of the 14 days, you're only going to have 7 hours to transmit the data back to, they're going to use the deep space network, by the way, because it will be at 60,000 miles. The low point near Earth is 60,000 miles, so it's, like you said, about twice the distance that the geosynchronous satellites are usually in. If the geosynchronous is 23,000, it's going to be 60,000, and the apogee will be out near the moon orbit. And one of the reasons they chose that orbit is to eliminate any kind of eclipse problem by running at 39 degrees in relationship to the moon. They would never have a problem of not only, you know, optical problems, but thermal problems. It would change the temperatures one way or another, even a little bit. They don't want to do that on the cameras. Or any equipment for that matter. Plus the solar panels. If you wind up in an eclipse situation and you're going slow, relatively going slow out to the moon before it starts coming back, you know, you could have, you know, days, maybe a couple of days at a time, when, you know, even 24 hours would be no good, where you're not going to be getting any sun to the solar panels. So that would be a problem. But having this kind of orbit where you're, you know, essentially like a pole, almost like a polar orbit type of thing for the moon, not quite, it's 39 degrees, but you'll never have a situation where you're going to be involved with an eclipse type of situation. So one question was asked, but they don't think it's possible. Will you be able to see a moon going around a planet that's going around a star? And they don't think it's possible, but, you know, they're going to give it a try. But I mean, that's how sensitive they're expecting to have this unit. Now, if I was there, I would have asked the question: how have the cameras changed? You know, since Kepler, Kepler was 2009. You know, here we are, years later. You know, are they the same cameras? That's one question I didn't find out. One guy did have a lens. He had a lens in his hand. He has one of the lenses. It looked like about four inches or so in diameter. And you said the cameras were one above the other. The cameras are, you know, it's like a box shape. You know, there's one above the other one, and then there's one next to it and one next to it. That kind of a design, Dick. You've seen the test spacecraft, right?
Yes, the observation end of the test spacecraft has four cameras. If you look at it top view, so to speak, they're in a square pattern. But the aiming of the cameras is such that it gives you a vertical stack of four chunks of sky, 24 by 24 degrees, but they're stacked on top of each other in elevation. So in elevation, you can cover from equator to pole by way of the 96 degrees of 24 times 4 in that direction, but only 24 degrees wide in azimuth, and that's what gets steps up every two orbits, I think you said. So in the first year, I guess it'll measure the whole southern hemisphere. The cameras themselves, I think they've got not a great number more megapixels. Let me drop. And a very complicated lens in front of each camera. What was it, seven elements or something like that to the lens. If I understand correctly, the angular resolution of TESS, each pixel is a little bit wider than it was with Kepler. But, in other words, it's set up in such a way that the ultimate sensitivity of TESS, if the camera was the same, the ultimate sensitivity is a little bit lower, but the field of view is quite a bit wider. And as such, it's more oriented toward measuring the brighter, close-by stars, and a hell of a lot more of them all at once. So it's a very well-designed machine. Getting back to James Webb, I think the original launching of James Webb was proposed to be 2017 and 2018 and 2019. I think you say we're now up to 2020. And because there is no repair capability, it's so far out, a million miles away, at the L2 Lagrange point. Let me drop this. They really got to make double darn sure that everything works, because there's no way of repairing it. So, do you know the nature of what's the latest thing they've discovered that's going to set it back up, Paul? WS2N, K2IW.
I've read that Taz and the sun shield problem, and some other problems apparently that aren't even being discussed. They're going to bring in an outside review board to look at it. And maybe this new guy, Jim Bridenstine, will be able to push them a little bit better to try to figure out what the problem is. They haven't had a NASA administrator all these years, which is unusual. They've never gone like more than a month. This is like 14 months. I don't know if that... I would imagine that's got to help, you know, anytime you have somebody in charge. The other guy was like an acting administrator, you know. Maybe I'm here another month, and maybe I'm not. In fact, he was quitting as... he was bailing out, so... I don't know if it's management or if it's engineering problems. I just don't know what other problems they could be having. We'll see when the report comes out. Back to you.
I think the sun shield on James Webb is something like five individual huge sheets of silverized mylar. Each one, I think, is almost as big as a tennis court. And so I guess they've... that's really got to work. That deployment of those five shields has to fold up very scientifically and be deployed with high reliability. So I think you're saying that on some of those experimental deployments under Earth's gravity, that the mylar sheets develop a tear. Is that what you're saying, Paul? Go ahead.
Yes, a couple of tears, and they're actually trying to repair it in place. You know, I think that it's a real complicated design. And then each one opens up individually, and each one isn't the same size. You know, each one is a little bit shorter as you go up. So they overcomplicated the whole project. They went from an $8 billion project, now I think it's $10 billion, and counting.
But that $10 billion is spread over a larger number of years. and NASA has a yearly budget of something like 18 and a fraction billion. So we're not approaching the point where they're using up the available funds. The good news about taking an extra year to launch is that you have more time to correct the errors, making sure that it's going to have a higher reliability. And in theory, there's some more money available because you're looking into the next year's worth of funding of NASA altogether. I'm probably a little wrong on this, but that's the way I look at it. Simplistically, Paul, I'll go to you. Back to you, K2RIW.
Yeah, and just recently they did get up to the $20 billion budget. And around $3.5 billion is spent on the International Space Station every year. They'd like to bring that to a grinding halt by 2025. Don't know how they're going to do that. But, that's right. It's spread out over the last 10 years at $10 billion. Plus, it's also spread out among some of our international partners. So they've helped out with it. So, yeah, it's not as drastic as it sounds, but still, you know, you like to see this thing get off the ground, okay? And the longer you wait, you know, certain parts, you know, kind of like age. I remember Galileo, before it went to Jupiter, was all ready to go, and all kinds of delays, all kinds of problems happened after Challenger. And we lost those 7 astronauts that they decided, well, we're going to launch on this rocket, maybe we won't. And everything went into hibernation for a while. But when they came time to open up that high-gain antenna on Galileo, it didn't open up. I mean, it half opened up. It was like a broken umbrella. So, you know, that kind of thing that started happening, you know, time goes by, you know, is all these parts really going to work 2, 3, 4 years later, like they're supposed to. I don't know. Back to you, Dick, and I'm running out of time. Wow, WS to us.
I wonder if Lou is still with us, NY2H. He said he sent me something over the last week, and I wonder if he can tell me what day he sent me something, because I haven't found it. NY2H, K2RIW, are you there, Lou? Maybe not. Okay, we've used up our time. That was TechNet number 1696. Space Report 296. Science and Physics Report. About helicopters and boxes, drones and boxes. That was report number 26. We'll be back next week. 73-year-old. Be kind to each other. If Roy is still with us, I'll pass it over to him for any final comments. And what's the puzzle going to be like next week, Roy? AC2GS, K2RIW.
AC2GS. Oh, you'll have to stay tuned for next week's puzzle next week. Keep in mind, once again, if you want to contact me, if you want to ask a question or suggest a topic, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And that page that I talked about earlier is now live, so if you want any of the links to any of the places that I've mentioned during my talk, just type in roy.ac2gs.com and you'll have a nice little list of the links that I've been talking about. Until next week, guys, thanks for listening. Thanks for participating. Thank you, Dick. Thank you, Paul.
Time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the WQVL repeater.
out there. I mean, to where why?
Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
tonight at 8:30 WQVL repeater system.